Chapter 5, The Possible Decade, 1977 to 1987. Well, Hisham, things changed in the mid-70s, and Kissinger and Ford found themselves gone. Step-by-step diplomacy was over. The 73 war had now receded into history for a few years, and a man by the name of Jimmy Carter and his national security advisor, Zbigniew Brzezinski, took over in Washington. That's also the period when I had first moved to Washington. You were where at that time? And you're still a kid.
Look, I was still a kid. I was in Palestine, living there and observing developments unfolding on the ground there. Candidly, I think this was the decade where almost, perhaps all parties, except the Israeli radicals, realized that establishing a Palestinian state was an unavoidable reality. That is, Kissinger and the United States realized, especially after the 1973 war, that there is no way to rule out, to cancel out the Palestinians from any equation. Yes, we of course recall that Kissinger stipulated a number of conditions for talking with the PLO, no recognition of the PLO without meeting a number of conditions, recognizing Israel, denunciation of terrorism, as he called it, et cetera, et cetera. But I think he deep inside, he realized that the PLO and the Palestinians were a fact on the ground. Number two, the PLO itself proved its ability to withstand a number of blows and a number of challenges. For one thing, the 1970 war, Civil War, September War in Jordan, the PLO, yes, came out weakened, but managed to steadfast and managed to survive and to rather revive itself even more strongly and more effectively in Lebanon.
Well, but Hisham,
too, then that's the second challenge.
When I got to Washington,
if I just may finish this point in Lebanon too. I mean, the challenge was humongous. The PLO found itself engulfed in a bloody civil war which consumed much of the country, and there too it managed to withstand much of the challenge there. And finally, the Israelis never left the PLO alone, especially in Lebanon, who internally and systematically they launched a number of attacks on the PLO in an attempt to weaken. They assassinated some of the best Palestinian national leaders from within the PLO. As a matter of fact, some of the most capable, some of the more active leaders, some of the most popular leaders were assassinated by Israel. So with all of this being done, it was clear that the Palestinians are not going to go away. They are there because the country is theirs, and therefore there has to be a realization of some Palestinian state. And in my view, this was the decade where the two-state solution began to be reconstructed, to be revived all over again after the 1950s and the first half of the 1960s, where that concept really dissipated.
Well, Hisham, I'm a little older than you. I had just come to Washington after finishing law school at NYU, finishing grad school in international affairs at Princeton, spending 4 years representing the international student movement for the UN as the chief representative at the UN headquarters in New York. When I got to Washington, my perspective is a little different on this. It wasn't Palestinian state that was being talked about. It was Palestinian autonomy. At most, it was Palestinian homeland. The idea was, well, you know, how are they going to be able to administer their own affairs? As I look back, I think the Israelis were realizing they're going to need to do something about this, and they were looking for ways to co-opt the Palestinians. They were looking for ways to keep the PLO out and find local leadership of, it was illegal if you were an Israeli to meet with the PLO anywhere in the world. In fact, you were arrested and imprisoned if you did. And when I befriended the two representatives that Arafat sent here in 75-76, Sabri Gerius, an Israeli lawyer, and Issam Sertawi, who in many ways should get credit for the idea of the two-state solution. That's another story for another time. I was tremendously chastised by the Jewish establishment for having any contact with them, and I was threatened, actually, and lost a number of very close friendships because I was told if I met with people in the PLO, they would not meet with me. So this was an extraordinarily intense period. Carter comes to power, immediately declaring human rights and self-determination at the top of his list. And he immediately attempted, I think that was the period of the Geneva Conference as well, which Kissinger and Ford had championed. And then Sadat comes along, and you'll remember my own role. I was invited to go to Egypt by the Egyptian government. I was invited to come to Lebanon by the PLO. I was invited to come to Tunis by the Tunisian government. And Sadat, of course, threw a monkey wrench into this whole thing by picking up and saying he was going to Israel and he was going to solve the problem. You were there at the time. I'd really like to hear how it appeared to you and the Palestinians when Anwar Sadat says he's coming to Israel to talk to the Israelis and the Knesset.
Well, absolutely, and I'll definitely say a few words about that, and it'd be great if you could also say some words about your involvement, your role in all of this, Mark, because I think you definitely played a role. Well, that was back in 1977. I do recall the exact dates, although I was, 14 years old. I was keeping up with what was happening. November 19, that's when Sadat came to Tel Aviv and then to Jerusalem. It was on the occasion of one of the feasts for Muslims, and Sadat decided to go and pray in the Aqsa Mosque to signify the importance of his visit. However, I do vividly recall how everyone was caught by surprise as the leader of the largest, the most effective Arab country, Egypt, decides unilaterally, that is, without prior consultation with other Arab leaders, to come and meet with Israeli leaders, and specifically with the Likud government in Begin. There was a sense of tremendous shock, tremendous surprise, because that was not expected whatsoever. And of course, Arab state TVs, whether in Syria or in other places, really chastised Sadat, and they called him a traitor. It was a period of so much confusion, I think, for us Palestinians, but nonetheless, it was clear that Sadat was basically trying to strike a deal for the sake of Egypt, but mainly really for his own sake. I mean, he was after fame, regardless of what means were used to achieve that fame, although he was considered as a peace hero in the West, in the U.S., he was despised in the Arab world among Palestinians and certainly mainly among Egyptians, and that's why he was assassinated a few years later.
But things were very different in those days. We've never really talked about this in the past. You say you were 14 years old. In those days, you were living 15 minutes or so by car from Jerusalem. I think you and other Palestinians could pick up. You could drive to Jerusalem. There were very few settlements at the time. There were the bypass roads. The apartheid hadn't really come and been implemented. there was still a sense of Palestinians controlling, or not controlling, they didn't control, but they lived in these areas, and these areas could be converted into autonomy, homeland, or statehood. You were a young teenager then. Were you already thinking of Palestinian statehood? Was the idea of a two-state solution something that you and your friends were contemplating?
Perhaps not exactly of the concept, but certainly I and, you know, my age could absolutely feel the urgency and the need for a Palestinian, an independent Palestinian homeland. I don't know what we call it then, a state or otherwise, but certainly knew that there was occupation. I listened very keenly to Sadat's speech to the Knesset on TV, of course. I think it was a historic speech, no question about it. He laid out the principles he wanted to work on. But, of course, as it turned out later on, when the Camp David Accords, the Camp David Treaty was signed, the Palestinians were left out, you know, from the equation. There was mention of autonomy for Palestinians in the Camp David Agreement, but nothing beyond that, and even that was not really worked on at all.
Well, as...
As I said, it was a period... Go ahead.
Well, as you mentioned, I was involved as a very young journalist just out of school. The brief sequence of events was I had written something about the peace process when Carter became president. There was a Brookings report I was publishing in The Nation and other magazines in those days. And it came to the attention of the Egyptian embassy, and they invited me to a movie about the conflict. I wrote something about that. And then one day they called and said, you know, we're very impressed by what you're writing. There had been something in the Washington Post on the op-ed page by the editor of the op-ed page about my own writings and about my seeing what this peace process was all about. And so they invited me to be their guest to go to Egypt for 3 weeks. In the process, I met all the important people, Osama El-Baz, who was sort of running the foreign ministry, Ismail Fahmy, who was just about to resign, the foreign minister, Boutros Ghali. I was at his home for dinner on the very day that it was just a dinner, me, his wife, and himself. On the very day, Sadat appointed him acting minister of state. And then I picked up, I went to Israel. There was going to be a big peace conference, and the very hours I arrived at the peace, at the New Outlook office, when they heard I'd been to Egypt, when they told me that while I was traveling, Sadat had spoken to his own parliament saying he was willing to do anything, including go to Israel and talk to the Israelis. Within hours, I was on a plane to Larnaca, figuring out how to get to Cairo, figuring out how to meet with President Sadat and give him the letter of invitation to this big peace conference where people were coming from all over the world. And Undersecretary of State, former Undersecretary of State George Ball, was the keynoter. And my God, I'll skip the story here, but yes, I got to meet with him. I spent an hour with him. I helped convince him he should make his trip to Israel. And we were all so hopeful at that time. Being older than you and coming from the different perspective, I know for sure we weren't talking about Palestinian state. The phrasing at the time was Palestinian homeland, even autonomy. There was a whole different sense of the relationship between Israel and the Palestinians, and there was still a lot of uncertainty about the relationship between the Palestinians and the Jordanians and what was going on in Lebanon, where the PLO had its headquarters then. But then Sadat changed everything. He eventually signed a separate peace, even though that's not, if you say there you were at 14 listening intensely to the speech, that speech was written by Boutros and others in the foreign ministry. And as I recall, I was there listening to it too. It was an excellent speech. He hit all the right notes. He said all the right things. But then at Camp David, he didn't do the right things, and his own foreign minister, his closest friend of 40 years, resigned. And that's another story. And there's a book by his foreign minister about what happened at Camp David. So then we've got the separate peace, and at that point, the Palestinians must have felt they'd been sold out. But you pick up the story then. When the separate peace happened, what was the sense in Palestine?
It is true, of course, that the concept of Palestinian statehood was not developed in the minds of the West. Although there was a realization, I think, an undeclared realization that the Palestinians are facts to be reckoned with, that the continued denial of Palestinians and of Palestinian rights does not work. Yes, it is true that the concept of Palestinian statehood is not fully developed, due to, of course, a number of factors, but mainly the impact of the Israeli lobby on policy over the years. Now, nonetheless, when Sadat came to Jerusalem and he signed the Camp David Treaty, yes, the Palestinians felt that they were singled out, that they lost one of the main bases in the Arab world, i.e. Egypt. And therefore, they needed to prove themselves all over again and to demonstrate to Kissinger and to others, to the U.S., that the Palestinians cannot be equated out, cannot be left out of any formula. So there were skirmishes, there were battles between the PLO and Israel in southern Lebanon, and it was a bloody period. The late 70s witnessed some of the bloodiest. There were massacres of Palestinians with the participation of a number of parties, including the Israelis, the Syrian army, and the rightist Lebanese forces, whether in 1976 through 1982, from Tell el-Zatar to Sabra and Shatila in 1982. So this was a very bloody period, the late 70s and the early 80s. The Kurdist government, the rightist government in Israel, wanted to compensate for signing what was viewed as a peace treaty by tightening the noose around the neck of the Palestinians. Much of the Israeli army that was on the Sinai Peninsula on that front and redeployed it in southern Lebanon. So they really launched some of the fiercest attacks on the Palestinians, on the PLO, whether outside, i.e. in the diaspora, in Lebanon, or inside, i.e. in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. Some of the strongest nationalist leaders were arrested in the West Bank and in the Gaza Strip, those who really represented Palestinian rights. And the Israelis wanted to establish an alternative leadership for the PLO. In 1981, I think we went over that at some point. They worked diligently and forcefully to establish what they called the village leagues, i.e. a number of leaders from Palestinian villages whom they viewed to be close to the Israelis, but at the same time to pose or to serve as an alternative leadership to the PLO. That didn't work in any way whatsoever because Palestinians were highly nationalistic. They were highly conscious of their rights, and that's where they reasserted time and time again that they cannot be singled out, they can be left out of any formula. From 1977 to 1987, this was a decade of continued attempts at survival by Palestinians politically, nationally, and existentially. As I said, a number of wars, a number of battles in Lebanon, so many measures, oppressive measures in the occupied territories, arrests, closure of the Palestinian institutions, closure of universities. Birzeit University, where I first attended back in 1981, in one academic year, was closed for 7 months. Many other institutions, unions, I remember when the Israeli soldiers would catch us as students from Birzeit, that was by itself a crime and punishable by Israeli so-called law. It was a very, very rough period. Yes, you're right. A Palestinian could still get to Jerusalem because the sequence and the mechanisms of checkpoints, the choke points, was not established as forcefully as it is today. But the measures, the oppressive measures of the occupation, were really instituted, and they were really, really harsh. I mean, a Palestinian could be easily arrested for possessing just a very casual book that mentions the name of Palestine, let alone if you possess a Palestinian flag or even a T-shirt with the colors of the flag by coincidence, you know, put on that T-shirt. That could cost a number of years in Israeli jail. So,
well, Hisham,
and this is why Palestinians were very skeptical, were very uncomfortable with the steps that made.
Your mention,
actually, as you said, after the signing of the treaty.
Your mention of the Palestinian flags triggers a memory which is actually quite significant. It's not talked about anymore. After the Camp David agreement,